content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And if I may add, as I record today's episode, I need to let you know there is construction underway nearby, so you may hear the occasional rumble of a truck, the whir of an electric tool, or some other building-related device whose noise can pierce our usually sound-resistant walls. Today on Armchair Traveler, we head to Florida, more specifically, the Everglades. As writer Nina Burley reports, Florida's freshwater wonder is threatened like never before with a rising sea level as restoration efforts lag. As you will hear, these efforts have been underway for some time. Nina's article, Tears for the Magnificent and Shrinking Everglades, A River of Grass, appeared in the January 27, 2020 issue of the New York Times. For years, whenever I found myself in Miami with an afternoon to spare, I sneaked off west to where a road abruptly separates the urban grid from the Everglades. Depending on time, I drove as deep into the sawgrass void as I could, parked, got out, and gazed up at tropical clouds racing unimpeded by tree or building. Then I usually burst into tears. Sky and grass, nothing else. It's a bit embarrassing to admit that anything in Florida, with its postcard palms plastered against postcard sunsets, its coconut tanning oil and Lily Pulitzer pinks and greens, its smalts and buffoonery and hanging chads and Florida man with his love of styrofoam weapons and monster trucks, that it affects me this way. But it does. There are no other Everglades in the world. They are, they have always been, one of the most unique regions of the earth, remote, never wholly known. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote in her 1947 book, The Everglades River of Grass, "The spears prick upward, tender green, glass green, bright green, darker green, to spread the blossoms and the fine seeds like brown lace," she wrote. "The grass stays, the fresh river flows." Where it's not diverted or blocked by human engineering, the water still trickles south at the rate of a quarter mile a day, as it has for millenniums. But it is profoundly imperiled by pollution, human schemes to drain and control it, animal and plant invasives, and sea level rise. As saltwater breaches the limestone bedrock around the Florida Peninsula and enters the aquifer, this natural freshwater wonder is threatened like never before. I've traveled far, but never found a place where the Garden of Eden and the fall of man are so palpable in one place. I am not alone. I know by the way eyes fill with tears when people get to talking about the glades. The Everglades were designed or designated a national park in 1947, the same year that its most ardent fan, the environmentalist Douglas, published her book. By then, dredging and pumping and draining of the sloughs, the technical term for the shallow, slow-moving water under the grasses, and species decimation was well underway. If doubt remains that Eden and the fall coexist here, consider that the name of the author who extolled the wonders of this paradise is affixed to a school, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, forever associated with the 2018 school massacre that left 17 people dead. In a series of trips to South Florida in the last year, I explored the interior of the River of Grass, the only subtropical wilderness in North America, plunging into microclimates and diminishing habitats, traversing slices of the Everglades National Park and its adjacent neighbor, Big Cypress National Preserve, by car, kayak, foot, and even looking down from a small plane. Yet after almost 2 weeks, I barely scratched around the edges of more than a million acres of wetlands, with nearly 300 species of fish and about 360 bird species, and more than 700 kinds of plants. Over the last year, with different family members as companions, I made several visits deeper into the Everglades than I'd ever been. We took kayaks and a skiff out into a maze of mangrove and shallow saltwater called the 10,000 Islands on Florida's southwest edge, sometimes pulling ourselves through these dense mangrove tunnels with our hands. These islands are historical hideouts for pirates, hermits, and criminals. Pot smuggling on local boats was so common here through the 1980s that locals nicknamed the illicit cargo Square Grouper. Today, sport fishermen ply the waters for boasting rights to the Grand Slam, hooking one of each of a redfish, snook, tarpon, trout, and spotted sea trout in a single day. Before dawn, we drove in darkness to the bird-festooned marsh trail in the 10,000 Islands National Wildlife Refuge. Mysterious ploppings, splashings, groanings, and crashings emanated from waters shrouded by the dense stands of palm and mangrove, and blue herons and great white egrets soared and settled again in the pink-tinted vapor rising around us with the sun. We hiked thigh-deep in cafe latte-colored water, slogging to explore the mysteries of the Cypress Domes. During the dry season from December through April, when most tourists visit the glades because it is virtually bug-free, these stands of swamp cypress rise, leafless and bone-white, above the grass, visible for miles. They look to be on high ground, but signal areas of deep water formed by dips in the limestone bedrock. Getting into and out of these domes can be a nerve-pricking enterprise, not for the faint of heart. Of course, we saw alligators, lots of them, from afar and in the water. These dinosaur relics resemble half-submerged junk tires. At night, only their eyes glitter in the beam of a flashlight. We got up close to them as they dozed, dry and oblivious in the sun, alongside roads or paths. Even a large mama gator, surrounded by about a dozen babies, sprawled lazily by the cycling path at the National Park Shark Valley, as groups of tourists 5 feet away recorded the family on their iPhones. I am here to attest that it is possible for a non-Floridian to get acclimated to alligators. The man to see for that is the Everglades guide, Garl Harrell. Garl, as he prefers to be known, grew up in Michigan, went south several decades ago, doffed his shoes, walked into the swamp, and never looked back or put his shoes back on for work. He picks up clients barefoot in a 12-person Ford van in the parking lot of a fruit stand outside Homestead city limits. He has silly nicknames for the monsters he claims lurk near his walks. Sneaky, she's around here somewhere. I saw Croczilla out here last week. He is encyclopedic on the flora, pointing out plants like the lemon bacopa that the Calusa and Tequesta tribes used as mosquito repellent, and the saltwort, a pale green, crunchy plant, great as a snack or in a salad. The cypress domes are worth the challenge. One, visible as a hump of trees from the main park road, is so cinematic on the inside that it is named the Movie Dome. It is a set designer's idea of a storybook tropical paradise. Sunlight shafting in, white branches festooned with proliferations of flowering epiphytes or air flowers, including rare orchids like the ghost orchid, plumed birds beating their wings so close you can feel their air move, all of it mirrored and doubled in crystal water around our knees. The experience can be transformative. Martha Calloway of San Antonio was touring the Everglades for a day while her husband fished in Key Largo. She said the slog was the high point of the day. The dome felt otherworldly, calm and peaceful. The bromeliads in the trees and the variety of plant life was fascinating. I also thought about the animal life that we weren't going to see because of the invasive species problem, and that humans are the worst invasive species of all. We have got to be more careful with the earth, she said. Her cousin, Carrie Labasso, agreed. When I told all my friends I slogged through a swamp, traveled with a python, and went hunting for alligator eyes in the dark night, most of them called me crazy. But I told them, and I really mean it, that experience will really stick with me. 2 centuries ago, the great naturalist and explorer, Alexander von Humboldt, was the first to comprehend the interconnectedness of nature and how humanity, or human activity, I should say, affected it. Humboldt never visited the Everglades, but it is surely one of the best places on Earth to observe nature's complex harmony up close. Every few feet of elevation produces a discrete ecosystem with its own animals and plants that not only adapted to but maintained the systems as well. It is the only place where both alligators and crocodiles coexist. The highest elevations in the Everglades are called pine rockland, and they are considered endangered habitat. Dry and high, prime real estate for mammals, of course man claimed it first, most of the old pine woods are paved over with towns and apartment complexes and strip malls whose names, Pinecrest, Pine Heights, Pines, refer to what was there. Slightly lower are the hardwood hammocks, just a few feet elevation above the river of grass, but still in it. Hammocks are visible for miles on the flat grasses. The mysterious cypress domes also tower above the grass, but they thrive just a few feet closer to sea level, or even in holes in the limestone below sea level. Viewed from above, they are teardrop-shaped, narrow at the top and bulging at the bottom, marking the shape of the water flowing in and around the holes. The Everglades formed 5,000 years ago. It once covered most of the peninsula of Florida, from Lake Okeechobee, the 10th largest freshwater lake in the United States, down to Florida Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. Since 1845, when Florida became a state, man has been refashioning the glades, chiefly to dry, build on, farm, and make money off the land, some of the most fertile in the world. Two big sugar companies now control 500,000 acres. Today, more than 8 million people also depend upon the glades for their drinking water. For 175 years, the drive to control the flow of water was planned, plotted, and executed with devastating results for native inhabitants, flora, fauna, and human. Dredging, levee building, pumping water in and out, more than 2,100 miles of canals, 2,000 miles of levees, and hundreds of floodgates, pump stations, and other water control structures, usually initiated with a blind zeal for progress and indifference to or ignorance about the fact that engineers were playing a game of Jenga on an interconnected, fragile system. All of New Jersey could have fit into the pre-drainage Everglades, but the ecosystem today is half the size it was before development. It is overrun by invasive plants and animals. As of 2015 in the Everglades, 60 plants were listed as endangered. The state of mourning began at least as far back as the 1920s when the botanist John Kunkel Small recorded his observations during an expedition listing the Latin names of hundreds of plants and recording everywhere signs of their degradation and demise from the approaching extermination of native coral life, which has come to pass around the Keys, to the ground itself being drained and burned until it is unproductive. His panic is palpable in the exclamation points in capital letters he deployed in his report on the Lake Okeechobee area. Here we were again, very forcibly impressed with the terrible destruction which is returning Florida to its primitive geological condition, namely a barren desert. Drainage and fire, the two processes are tending to eliminate all the native life from the state. Thus, the magnificent monument that took ages to construct has been wrecked within the fraction of a generation, he wrote. What's gone is gone, and what's still there is threatened by invasives like the cattails and the ornamental plant Brazilian pepper that leapt from people's manicured gardens and into the Everglades. The pepper is so endemic that the Park Service is mulching it and sequestering it in small mountains visible from above as bright green squares throughout the backcountry. Non-native bamboo now chokes waterways and birding marshes throughout the park. Along with plants, the Burmese python is an unwelcome invader, probably introduced into the habitat first by pet owners when they got too big to keep in the condos. The snakes grow to tremendous length and weights. 15-foot 90-pounders have been found. They wiped out 99% of the marsh rabbit and the raccoons, decimated the otters, and are now setting their sights on the birds. Researchers chip male pythons and track them to the nest of huge mother snakes, removing hundreds of eggs. In just 2 days, we saw two giants caught by the roadside in the area and heard tell of a third. The state sponsors annual python-killing competitions. The winner of the 2020 Python Bowl gets a truck. There are success stories. Alligators were nearly hunted to extinction in the 1960s, but surged back after restrictions. So have the birds. The Victorian taste for big hats with plumage led to near extinction of the Everglades snowy egrets and other wading birds, with more than 5 million birds killed annually by 1900. Anti-plumage campaigns at the turn of the 20th century stopped that. All over the Everglades, efforts to save something rare are underway. Panthers are collared and tracked near Big Cypress Preserve, but 21 were hit by cars last year out of an estimated statewide population of only 150. Sections of T-Miami Trail, the main east-west road connecting Miami and Naples, are being turned into bridges to allow water to flow back into the sloughs to the south, bringing back native vegetation for the first time in a century. At least one river, the Kissimmee, straightened by the Army Corps of Engineers to benefit the northern farms, has been returned to its natural bed. In 2000, the state and federal government agreed to a $4 billion comprehensive Everglades restoration plan. 20 years on, a few of the major infrastructure projects have been built, but most are still on the drawing board awaiting money. In a promising development, Congress just authorized $200 million to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for Everglades restoration. The Everglades Foundation is among many area nonprofits studying the effects of human activity on the freshwater flow and advocating efforts to restore the ecosystem. We know what the consequences of inaction are because we've already experienced it. Polluted waterways, toxic algae, seagrass die-off, continued habitat loss, and even threats to imperiled species, said Stephen Davis, a Foundation scientist. We simply cannot afford to wait any longer, he adds. Without Everglades restoration, Florida's tourism-based economy is at risk. Paddling in Florida Bay one night at twilight, Garl trailed his hand in the warm, salty water and pulled up some gray muck, let it drip back into the murk. When I first came down, this water was clear, and I used to dip my hand in here and pull up a handful of sand and seagrass and find dozens of baby clams and tiny living shells, he said. It's all gone. We're in a dead zone now. As he spoke, a full moon rose behind us, and roseate spoonbills sailed in V formation across pink cumulus clouds, fading into periwinkle to the west. I, as usual, choked back a sob. Florida Bay has not recovered from a great sea grass die-off in 2015 because of unusual salinity caused by the man-made diversion of fresh water away from the bay. All Florida shores have been plagued by a series of deadly red tides caused by fertilizer and other pollutants. Worse, as sea levels rise around Florida, increased salinity on the edges of the Everglades is killing the sawgrass, setting off a cycle of damage to the sediment, allowing even more salty water farther inland. Knowing all that, I wasn't so bothered by the legendary Everglades mosquitoes that came out with the spectacular sunset. You can set your watch to that, locals say. As they pricked away at exposed skin and whined in my ears, I took it as proof that, for now anyway, the threatened glades biome lives on. Nina Burley is a journalist and author. Her most recent book, Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women, is due out in paperback later this year. From the Florida Everglades, we head west to join writer Dan White in the Sierra Nevada and escape to the past. His article was published in the August 7th, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. As Dan relives some childhood memories with his family, we gain a close-up view of the Mammoth Lakes Basin in California. When I was a child, Mammoth Lakes, California was my annual escape from hatchet-faced bullies, geometry quizzes, and Los Angeles County smog. At 7,881 feet at Sierra Nevada's eastern edge, the informal and slightly run-down ski town always made me breathless and dizzy for the first couple of days. But I loved the cinder cones, the lupine fields, the eerie moonscape of Obsidian Dome, and the flat-bodied bugs that jumped over my boots on the Shadow Lake Trail. But when my wife and daughter asked if we could take a vacation to Mammoth Lakes this July 2020 as a break from sheltering at home in Santa Cruz, I refused. Since I have asthma, I've mostly secluded myself during the pandemic. Besides, I've avoided Mammoth since 2016 when my father died. I didn't want to risk nostalgia or virus exposure. Then my daughter Juliana, 11, started texting me photos of chocolate frosted flakes and Cocoa Krispies. I understood the reference. Juliana longed for the freedom I told her I had at Mammoth, where my parents let me binge on any sickening sweet 80s cereal I chose. I could also stay up late and float in the hot tub all day. Juliana deserved a reprieve. My family prevailed. We agreed to stick to the woods in wide open spaces, avoiding restaurants, steering clear of public restrooms, and staying away from crowds as much as possible. And we arranged to stay at a condo unit that had been left vacant for a minimum of 24 hours before our arrival. As we rolled into Mammoth Lakes, Belding's ground squirrels ran across the asphalt with their tails held high. Nostalgia set in when I saw the jagged wall of Mammoth Crest and the Minaret Peaks, which looked like a pointier and more fragile version of Antoni Gaudi's Sagrada Familia Basilica in Barcelona. There were gaudy newer elements, including the village at Mammoth, an upscale complex near the ski slopes, but the town's layout hadn't changed. Gift shops still sold scratchy souvenir T-shirts with smiling mammoths on skis. It was easy to believe no time had passed. Our Snow Creek Resort condo rental evoked childhood trips from the dinged-up board games to the framed bathroom poster of a skier plunging spread eagle from a frosted cliff. The resort launched contactless check-in as lockdown was lifted. My wife was emailed the key code to the condo before our arrival. We'd brought disinfectant and planned to wipe down all the surfaces, but it didn't seem necessary. Cleaners had already disinfected all high-touch surfaces, including the entry keypad, doorknobs, and bathroom fixtures. All towels and bedding had been washed and placed in a hermetically sealed bag. In some ways, the virus threat contributed to the time warp. Because of coronavirus concerns, the usual shuttle down Red's Meadow Valley Road, which runs close to the middle fork of the San Joaquin River, wasn't operating. The rangers let me drive my car down that narrow strip of asphalt, just as my father used to do in the early 70s. When we stopped by Soakter Lake near the road, Juliana learned to skim stones and duck to avoid dragonflies, just as I'd done on the same shoreline. A grocery trip brought me back to reality. The town was overrun, despite the virus threat. Mammoth's main visitor's website has a clear message to tourists. Mammoth is open, as long as visitors take precautions, including masks and social distancing. But now I was part of a growing horde. Tourists thronged the sidewalks and lined up 50 deep for outdoor dining. Most wore masks, but social distancing was sometimes a matter of millimeters instead of feet. Later, I would read news reports that Mono County, which includes Mammoth Lakes, had been placed on the California coronavirus watch list because of a surge in cases. According to a Los Angeles Times report, the surge was tied mostly to Mammoth Lakes restaurants. Some waterfronts were also jam-packed. When I tried to revive an old tradition of taking a paddle boat out on Lake Mary, we had to swerve to avoid armies of paddleboarders, pontoon boat operators, and annoyed fishermen. Should asking a stranger to take your photo go the way of the daguerreotype? On most visits to Mammoth, I felt unfulfilled unless we checked off a list of must-dos, drink a sunset beer at a bar with a viewing deck, eat pastries at Chez Chat Bakery, go out for a fancy meal on the last night. I tore up the list. It was time for the backwoods. On the second day, after packing turkey sandwiches, we hiked toward Sky Meadows. Ponderosa pine trees smelled like raw cookie dough. We saw a few backpackers, but a few people were out exploring the fields of corn lilies. When we reached Emerald Lake, my daughter scrambled up unstable-looking boulders and returned 10 minutes later. "Come with me," she said. I heaved up the slope, my fitness tracker flashing 143 heartbeats per minute. I had to catch my breath. Juliana waited by the drop, the lake far below us. "Look," she said, pointing to the plates, ridges, and fans of a mountain, with forest and rockfall along the massive base. I didn't think Mammoth held surprises for me, but that vantage point was a shock. It was as if I'd entered a landscape I'd never seen. At the end of the trail, Sky Meadows was deserted. Across the creek, the sheer and ominous form of Blue Crag rose above patches of ice, snow, and scree. My parents did this steep trail late into the 70s. I used to race ahead, stacking kerns at tricky intersections so they would not get lost. Now my daughter was watching out for me. On the way down the slope to the trailhead, she handed me a branch. "Use it as a walking stick," she said. Her offer made me feel grateful and proud, but also elderly and enfeebled. On the last day, we wanted an easy hike to TJ Lake. Muddle-headed, I went to the wrong parking lot. We wound up on the steep trail to Crystal Lake, which I'd never seen. The wind kicked up, and the altitude got to my wife. This is the wrong path to the wrong lake, Amy complained. I expected Juliana to be annoyed, too. She dislikes changes of plans, but she's becoming rougher lately, scrambling up trees, dunking into creeks, leaping off rocks, and getting stung by bees and wasps without crying. She raced up switchbacks over exposed roots. It will be worth it, she said. The slope dropped us into a rocky bowl containing Crystal Lake. It was strange to come across a mammoth landmark that was not a storehouse of old memories. A young boy stood on a rock island, casting his line. The virus has winnowed our options, limited our movements, but somehow we'd find a way to surprise ourselves in a familiar place I thought I'd never go again. Later, we were on a narrow meadow in front of the Snow Creek condo village, watching mountains turn pink and orange, when someone called our names. We turned to see Justin and Marissa, whose son is in our daughter's class. After getting over the shock of this random encounter, we chatted. Turns out Marissa's parents have been visiting Mammoth since 1963. She's been going as long as she can remember, watching fireworks at Crowley Lake outside Mammoth on the 4th of July, canceled this year because of the pandemic, and also taking countless hikes. One summer, two sisters who lived in town scattered their leftover Halloween candy throughout the woods that used to be in the center of town and christened it Candyland, she recalled. All the kids in town hunted down candy all that summer. In July, they were sustaining their mammoth traditions with their two sons, but this year felt different, Justin told me. He felt sheepish about being part of the crowd at a jam-packed grocery store. I'd be lying if I said I didn't feel guilty and a little bit selfish for coming this year. His concerns reflect one of the realities of life in California during a pandemic. Try to get away from it all as safely and respectfully as you can, but when travel is limited and options are few, you may find crowds wherever you roam. Still, I was grateful for the trip's quieter moments. At Mammoth, you normally can't pause near a meadow for long because of biting insects. This time, a bat hunted and scooped up the mosquitoes. The bat kept flapping as the dark closed in. We walked back to the condo, making our way without a flashlight. Listening to the disembodied voices, I could almost convince myself it was my parents, my brothers, and my sister beside me, taking one last stroll around the neighborhood before turning in and getting ready for the long trip home. Wow, great story, huh? Well, we're going to close out with a quick stop to somewhere nearby. It's called Smithfield, North Carolina. This, written by Christy Tolley, and appears in the September-October 2020 issue of AAA Go magazine. A little brief reminiscence of Smithfield's history. Chartered in 1777, Smithfield is the county seat for Johnston County, North Carolina. The town is named for John Smith, who owned much of the land on both sides of the Neuse River. Historic attractions, fantastic food finds, and varied diversions. There are lots of reasons to make this historic town your road trip destination if you need to take a quick trip away from home. So that's just a suggestion, and we thank Christy Tolley for giving us that. Again, she is writing for the AAA Go magazine. Well, that's just about it for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, or O-R-G. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.